Hello and welcome to Pain in the Dice.
Because games are fun, but sometimes hard. So Terry, what you playing?
That is a fascinating question, Chaz. I recently, on the player side, I went to Gen Con 2023. And the first thing I noted when getting there was the number of people who were like, stay safe. I've seen pictures of the crowds. It looks like people aren't masking. They did not, which I expected. This was not a surprise. But there were 80,000 people there. And I counted, I think all 80,000 of them were in the dealer's room Thursday morning waiting to get in, just in the foyer of the convention center. Yeah. And people were like, that's so many people. I'm like, you couldn't even crowd surf on this. I've seen more at a mindless self-indulgence concert. The two games I got to play, one was Ashen Stars, which is a gumshoe game, and it was perfectly lovely. And I will quickly summarize it by saying, hey, Chaz, I think it'd be fun if your character and my character did this to develop character. And the storyteller just looked at it and goes, no time, mystery to solve. So, you know the way you and I frequently talk about the different points in the plot versus characterization spectrum?
Yeah.
I have discovered that there is a point beyond me in terms of let's just do some effing plot. And that was fun. And then I got to play a game of
Crick-Ass and Chew Bubblegum?
Yes. And that was...
How did that go?
It was lovely. I was full of gum by the end of it. I arrived slightly late and had to leave slightly early. So I was the special guest star. And they still let me to participate. So I'm still not entirely sure how the game is played. But I came to the scene midway through terrorists having hijacked a school bus full of agricultural students. So, and then it kind of went from there. That was enjoyable. But the biggest thing I did was, the two highlights were having Ken Hyatt go, heh, at me, because I encountered Ken Hyatt and Robin Laws walking the halls, and I forgot a critical fact. One, I am 39 and in a reasonably good cardiovascular condition for my size. So the fact that they were more or less jogging and I was keeping up with them and could still talk was a little bit rude towards them, because I'm like, Ken Hyatt, I love the work you did on Sorcerer's Crusade. To which Ken Hyatt said, hey, and then continued shuffling along. Later, I was able to see them at the Pelgrane booth and apologize for yelling at them while they were jogging earlier. And they're like, oh, that's fine. You gonna buy anything? And I did. And now we're friends. But more importantly, I ran a bunch of sessions of Hunter 5th Edition. Is it the 5th Edition of Hunter? No. It is Hunter the Reckoning for Vampire 5th Edition.
I know you ran Vampire 5th Edition last year as well. Now Hunter 5th Edition. How do you find the X5 system and game?
The system itself is fine. It is fine. The fact that Hunter 5th was up for an any strikes me as the board for the any is like, hey, what new games came out this year with new rule systems? And then they looked at 1,100 indie games with inscrutable but probably fine systems. And they're like, shit, if we recognize one of them, we're going to have to recognize all of them. Any trad games come out? Hunter 5th Edition. Okay, it gets a nomination. And that's how Hunter 5th got a nomination. I describe V5 as grilled chicken. It is a good source of protein. You're like, this is fine. This is nice, but you want more. You need some curry on it. You want some barbecue sauce. It does not have the barbecue sauce, Chaz. And then there's the Game of Mage, where it's only barbecue sauce, and some of the barbecue sauce is expired, but it's mostly barbecue sauce. V5 at least gives you, like, I don't know, like maybe a Cajun ranch dipping sauce. It's the same Cajun ranch dipping sauce every time, but it's a good sauce. Hunter is just grilled chicken, maybe with some pepper on it.
I am only mildly familiar with Hunter 5th Edition, having absorbed it primarily through the podcastosphere. But from what I've heard, it is more in line with games like Hunters Hunted, which focus on just mortals hunting vampires, than it is with Hunter the Reckoning in the original World of Darkness, where you play imbued and empowered characters. Is that Is that right? How does Hunter fit into the wider World of Darkness?
It is about as imbued as the first time your manager gave you the store key and said, "Here, Chaz, you have to close tonight. I'm too hungover to do it." And for that brief moment, you're like, "He recognized me." And then seconds later, that effect wears off and you're like, "This is stupid. I want to go home." You are not imbued. The characters you are hunting are almost exclusively more interesting than you are. Like you read the antagonist write-up and you're like, "These are great." But yeah, it is like Hunter's Hunted, but even less so. You don't have access to true faith. You don't have access to psychic powers. You don't have access to linear magic. You don't have access to noumena. You don't have access to charms if for whatever reason you got your hands on a fetish or a talon or something. We have no information on work-life balance or mechanisms to support it. It presumes that you're going to die, and it gives you no mechanic to replace your character. Like, Call of Cthulhu, the character you start with is not the character you end up with, and not in the Heraclitus sense of no one steps into the same river twice, but literally you're going to go through your character and seven of their cousins before you're done this game. Everything is mundane, and the game wants it to be atmospheric. Clue acquisition is slow, and it made me realize why supernatural powers are cool. It's because it lets you bypass the bullshit that you and I have to deal with in real life, where we're like, "Oh, I need this form signed before I can get my mortgage transferred to my new mortgage dealer. Well, Mindy isn't in today. You need to come back tomorrow." But with magic, you can be like, "Ah, I fake her signature. Ah, you're going to sign for her. Ah, I can see that she's in her office and she's also hungover," or something like that. Hunter, you get none of that whatsoever. It is aggressively mundane. The other thing that I think is funny is there's no power that lets you know who someone is. So the game really wants there to be this ominous mystique of like, "Oh, what are they?" But you can get into a circumstance where your character deals 3 extra dice of damage against vampires, but there is no power in the game that can confirm that they're a vampire. And in the games I ran, it was against mages. And one of the things about mages is it is not obvious that someone is a mage. Like, a vampire is literally dead. And I'm like, "Oh man, Terry, you picked a great one." The powers are also real weird because they're listed as lasting for a scene.
How do hunter powers work? You were basically saying that hunters didn't have powers. So I assume these are non-powered mechanical effects that represent training, technique, something like that?
That would be far too interesting, Chaz. Oh, most of the powers I will summarize as you know a guy. And the way it works is to activate your hunter power. Frequently, you are rolling trait plus trait, attribute plus skill against difficulty 4, meaning you need at least 4 successes to get it. And if you do, you get the thing. So I may have the edge of armored vehicle, meaning if I roll my manipulation plus craft to represent I have a vehicle I can borrow, and I get at least 4 successes, I can borrow that vehicle for a scene. I don't know about you, but any circumstance where I would want to borrow a scene is too short. And then I'm like, "Oh, maybe they redefined scene." They didn't. It's whatever the basic unit of narrative thing. So you immediately have this thing where you're like, "Well, they're in the middle of this car chase, but it's actually another scene." It's the other guy like
turns into a pumpkin, exactly. Right on the highway. You fall out, you get terrible road burn.
And it's frustrating because, like, if you're the guy whose superpower is I have the van, you should just have the van. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
In actuality, though, if you have a group of 5 people and they all have 2 edges and there's some overlap, one of them's going to work, probably. And the fact that you can take a superficial willpower damage to roll 3 dice, reroll 3 dice, makes it pretty good. And the fact that double zeros are 4 successes, the dice math works out in a way I didn't quite anticipate. Like, higher successes are a little bit more likely. And as you increase the number of dice, you kind of get this, the odds of any zero matching with another zero, like, steadily increases. So once you get a dice pool of like 8, the odds of you actually getting those double zeros is hitting like 40%. So it surprisingly does work out, but it's real frustrating to be like, "I'm the character and this is the cool thing I can do." Sometimes.
If I were going to put my design hat on for a second, I think what I would want to do is something a little bit more like using your contacts in Story Path, where you can do it the first time free, and after that you're pushing. So maybe it's across all of your edges, whatever edge you're calling in, and in the longer unit of time happens automatically, and then you've got an escalating difficulty or success after that to represent your network being tapped out in some way. But having a power that you always have to roll to see if it does anything at all is kind of one of those bad feel things from my perspective in a game. Unless, like, it's an opposed roll against another character, like, I'm going to try to put the whammy on this character. Yes, I expect to have to roll, just like I'd have to roll to attack them, and then my roll is going to give me some kind of bonus. I don't know. That irks me when I think about it.
The other reason a roll can make sense, though, is if you want margin of success. And to be like, right. Yeah, okay, no successes, you get the van.
Yep.
Five successes, it's armored. Six successes, you get a Bradley fighting vehicle or something like that. Yeah, but that's not the game it wants you to play, annoyingly. The other thing is, I also got to playtest Hunter when it was in playtest. And I get the sense that a lot of those mechanics were only banged on from that setting. The kind of drive it like you stole it, the storyteller is going to give you clues because they want you to make it to the final showdown kind of thing.
Okay.
And a lot of games don't reveal themselves fully on that level of play. So if you have something where it's like, oh, what is it like when you've started to accumulate these points of willpower damage, so on and so forth, like what does a character look like after four sessions? And it's interesting because superficial and aggravated damage are still recovered surprisingly quickly. I mean, you and I cut our teeth in Old World of Darkness, where to go from incapacitated to mauled was like 3 months or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. And here everyone is fine in a week if they get intensive medical care. Which is fine. I don't care that much about it.
I mean, I think that again, that's one of those things that is better for gameplay.
Yeah, but alternatively, you would have something where it would be troop style play, and you would substitute your character out for another one, and be like, oh, on this one we need the lockpick guy. But also, it's trying to set up a world where it's really your small insular cell able to investigate what's going on in the wider world. Like, it doesn't want that superhero-y feel, but there is no consideration on your character's mundane life. And the game both wants you to have advancement, and it says anyone who's completed like 9 hunts is going to be like revered as a master by other hunter cells. There were a lot of weird internal tensions that didn't quite make sense to me in the game.
Okay.
So for instance, you pick a creed, which is your character's view of the hunt. Am I here mostly for information? Am I here mostly for money? Which is different than your drive. Remember that, kids. Your creed determines when you can bang on the other key mechanic, desperation dice. So this game includes a ballast system, which is to say every time your group gets wrong-footed or takes a punch to the face or the enemy gets away, you increase the desperation level. Every time your group either screws up in a certain way that the bad guy would notice or has a big win, the danger level increases. Desperation dice is fully mechanized. So you can say, oh, your character is faithful. You have the faithful creed. You can add desperation dice to any role that is a direct confrontation with the supernatural. This also raises an immediate problem because how do I know if someone's a supernatural or not when we don't really have... Anyway, so it raises some, to me, metagame questions that are kind of weird. And you get to roll those dice and that's real cool. But the problem with that is early in an investigation, that desperation pool is going to be quite low. So if your character is really good at investigation, you don't get to call on that because normally you're going to have initial encounter or investigation, build up evidence, figure out what their weakness is, hit them with all you got. And the further down you are in that, the more likely that danger level is to be high. So if your superpower is investigation, F you don't get desperation dice because there hasn't been an opportunity for your group to be wrong-footed such that there are desperation dice for you to call on, where anyone who's probably good at that final showdown with the boss is going to have a meaty handful of desperation dice to call on just because it's further into the narrative arc and the desperation and the danger level are going to be higher. And danger is only semi-mechanized, where a storyteller might say something like, oh, they have a number of bodyguards equal to 2 plus the danger level or something like that, which is fine and is a useful guide. But even in the one-shots I played, when the danger level went up, the characters are like, players are like, what does that mean? I'm like, stuff's harder.
Like, things are more dangerous.
Yeah.
It's no danger level.
Well, it's the three, unless it's a weird DEFCON thing where the lower number is worse. I can never remember how that goes.
How did the V5 core system work for Hunter with all of these extra mechanisms?
Beautifully. Cannot fault it for that. The number of times where I said, how many dice do you have to roll? And the character's like, I've 10 dice or something like that because of some set of circumstances. And I just got to say, okay, cool. You succeed. And the players just like let the dice fall back to the table like they had betrayed them. They would give this look like, I'm sorry, guys, you heard what he said. I just succeed. My character is capable in this particular way. Kept things moving. Combat was fast. People were like, oh, do I roll initiative? I'm like, no. You're running at him with a baseball bat. You get to go first. And they're like, okay, that makes sense. And things like that. The characters are very squishy. That was a hard thing to dial in, to be like, oh man, he's putting off a bunch of C4. It's going to cause this, like someone might die. So it was real important that the characters knew how willpower damage worked, where you can spend a point of superficial willpower to reroll three dice because your ass is going to be dragging once you start taking ag damage to health. But in that regard, it moved. Calibrating difficulty was a little bit hard. Knowing what a good 4, 5, or 6 challenge was took me a while to figure out in terms of things. And I think there could still be a little bit more assistance in terms of what does it mean when characters are helping each other. The way the core system works is like, if you get assistance, you get one extra die. You're like, is that how I want to? But otherwise, I can't complain. The V5 core system worked wonderfully. The dice math is straightforward and we could just play.
Nice.
The game is very designed for hunting werewolves and hunting vampires. You see all the special equipment and you're like, this does fire damage and so on. So you're like, but if we're going to go up against like a water nymph or something like that or something, or a ghost, what even? So it felt very hollow there. And even it was weird looking at the supplements that they've released, even those are very light on details on antagonists. It's very vague. It has this weird web of clues that a character kind of needs to pick up on. So it's just very chunky on what players will and won't get. It felt so weird to go from Gumshoe, where it's like, I'm going to look at the bullet patterns because I'm good at looking at bullet patterns. And the storyteller is like, well, here's your bullet pattern clue, to this game where it's like, what do you do? And they're like, look around. And I'm like, yeah, what actually would you see? That was a little bit frustrating. Like, just give me that. Give me a clue system. Give me a character system. But otherwise, can't complain.
Okay. How did the games you ran went?
I think they ran well. So the two things I did that were weird were I ran 3 games. They were 5 hours apiece. Chaz, 5 hours of continuous gaming is a lot for me. You and I used to play Invisible Sun over lunch breaks. That was like an hour and a half. And I'm like, perfect. That's the exact amount that I could do. So that 5 hour session was kind of a 15 minute intro, 45 minutes of making characters and the cell using my weird method. You spent 90 minutes with an utterly disposable character with names like Ort Klumps and Chim Richards. And you were the previous hunting group. And then the rest of the time, it was your actual characters you had made doing the hunt. And we had break after each 2 hour window. One thing that had spoiled me about running games online is you can have a 10 minute or a 5 minute break. But when you're at a convention center and the bathroom is 4 minutes away, like 50. Yeah. So the way I did character creation was you picked a template card. And that determined how many starting dots you got in stamina, dexterity, whatever, and a bunch of other things. And since they were mine, I got to pick what they were. And they were things like stay-at-home survivalist. I'll tell you the true symbolism of the $1 bill after I pick up the kids from soccer practice. And another one was the most successful magician in your region who got 1 dot of resources, just kind of as my dig at professional magicians. A church drag racer, but I could just have fun with these.
Right.
So you pick the template, and then you got to pick 2 edges. I had them all printed out on cards with a little system rundown. You got to pick an advantage, which was a background or a merit. You got to pick some descriptive stuff about how you approach the hunt. And then we answered some questions about the crew. So I would say, Chaz, the previous leader of your cell is gone. Why? And I just ask the leading questions that I always like to do. 2 of you really hate a particular supernatural type. Why is that? And it's fun running games back to back sometimes because the weird things that just seem to be in the air. 2 separate groups picked leprechauns as the supernatural that they hate. One of them kind of like revealed their hand. They're like, they're technically clerics. They're like, change, like, change, like. two of you are part of the same weird club. What is it? And two of them were like Toastmasters. So I really like the idea that you feel comfortable. Like you're afraid of vampires, but you're truly afraid of public speaking. Like that's the real nemesis. I got rid of Desire and Ambition just because there wasn't time for those mechanics. And I replaced it more or less with Archetype from Old World of Darkness, just because you can do that in a session. You can be arrogant or a dictator or a artist or something like that. That method went really well. No one wound up using Desire and Ambition. Creed also went largely unused. We just kind of went by the feel of, do I think my character should be able to call on desperation dice now? And that was more tied to edge and character concept than anything else. I wasn't sure if people were going to want to see the system as in, let's use the disposable characters first and then build a character, now that you kind of know how everything works. But everyone was like, no, I want to build my character now. And then we gave them entirely disposable characters, which were the previous hunter group that was going to do the handoff. Did you ever watch Futurama?
I've seen a little bit of it.
So in literally the first episode of Futurama, Fry needs a career chip, and the professor is like, I happen to have one. And he pulls out an envelope labeled Space Wasp's Stomach Contents and gives it to Fry and like chips him. And that's basically how this works. So your older characters broke into the Dayton, Ohio Chamber of Commerce. I set the whole thing in Dayton, Ohio. And before I started, I'm like, does anyone here know anything about Dayton, Ohio? And everyone was like, no. I'm like, good, me neither. Let us begin. And we just made up things about, like, I had actual facts just in case someone were a Daytonian or something like that. And to be like, oh yeah, right, Patterson Air Force Base. But like, people got to be Dink Dinkins, the 80s hacker, and a septuagenarian weightlifting champion. The actual adventure I did, I kind of did Ken Height's Sea of Clues. I didn't have specific clues, but it was just one of those things like, no matter what direction you looked in, there was an arrow pointing at the antagonists. And there were three different sets of antagonists, and you could pick, and you got like a little dossier. So the group got to say, hey, based on who my character is and the way they approach the hunt, this is the one that I think would be the one we would take after. So there was a group that was doing, there was a pair that was kind of doing direct harms to people by kind of fomenting gang warfare to sell arms. Another one was manipulating ghosts for business purposes. And another one was just kind of doing like subtle mind manipulation to change the political landscape of the area. And it was kind of a compromise between, well, we have this clue and this is the thing I actually wanted to go after. So as always in games, I am interested in seeing the choices the players make, not whether or not they succeed or fail. So right. Yeah, kind of what was that trade-off? And I was very pleased with how it worked out. I kind of want to put it on the Storyteller Vault, but I have no idea how. So like, I have all these little cards and I'm like, okay, well, here's an Excel spreadsheet that will allow you to do a Microsoft Word mail merge. So I hope you have these four types of Avery labels. Like the real star of the show was my tiny thermal printer. Chaz, have I talked to you about how much I love this little thing?
You have not.
I got a tiny thermal printer. It's about the size, it's about 2 inches by 2 inches by 7 inches. And it just USB plugs into it and it prints out on thermal labels, which I like because it is incredibly fast. The players can handle it and it won't smudge because it's thermal. Like if you were to rub it against the edge of a table, it would, kind of like in the same way you could do it with a receipt. And just as we were going, I could print out a clue card, slap it on a card and put it on the table rather than like people having to look at my shitty handwriting.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. For listeners at home, you cannot see, but I'm holding up the reasonably nice printed cards that I was able to make.
Ooh.
Anything I wanted players to know, if it was a lot, I put it on a 4x6 card. If it wasn't a lot, I put it on a 2x3 card. So that is now a new addition to my gaming accessories. I didn't think, where it's like, okay, everyone got their dice? Yeah. Terry, do you have your thermal printer? Yeah. Let's game. Very pleased with how that part turned out, but it was utterly draining and utterly exhausting. I looked at, like, I wear a smarch and I'm like, yeah, I did pretty good. And I'm like, and I'm still hopped up on adrenaline from the first game I ran, which was 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. And I get home and I'm like, wow, my heart rate's pretty high. I must have really pedaled quickly. I biked to Gen Con from where we were staying from the place. That was amazing too. But like, I look back and I'm like, oh, my heart rate was like at 120 for 4 hours. This would explain why I am very tired and very hungry at 1:30 a.m. in Indianapolis.
Besides running too many games of Hunter and playing in a couple of games, what else did you do at Gen Con?
So I am going to cheat and answer in two different ways. I met up with some people that I had known. I recorded an interview, a walk around with the distributor. And that was mostly it. Like, the three games probably consumed the equivalent of almost 2 days of time between like final prep work and actually running the damn sessions. And like, it's one of those things where it cost me, what did it come out to? It cost me $700 to go to Gen Con, but I got the badge for free. Like, it saved me like a- So I will probably not be doing that. Again, there was one person that just kind of stared at me as I was talking, and they're like, and I'm like, hi, Mage fans. And they're like, ooh. And I'm like, hi, hello, I'm Terry. And then they recognized it and then immediately left. Like, they were only interested in verifying where they knew me from and not actually engaging with me as a person.
Okay.
Anyone who was associated with Mage the Ascension, I wish them a happy 30th, because Gen Con this year was the 30th anniversary of that. There were a few humorous attempts at me trying to wish that to Malcolm Shepard. And every time I attempted to do that, he either couldn't hear me or like rapidly turned away or was engaged in something else, which I think is a good summary of, from what I understand, Malcolm Shepard's current interest in Mage the Ascension as a game, having moved on to being one of the creative powerhouses at Green Ronin. It was fascinating seeing what was on the show floor. All the weird indie games that had exploded over COVID seemed to have been reined in a little bit. And more dealer space was trad stuff. Like, Indie Press Revolution had a lot more copies of games I recognize as games.
Okay.
As opposed to, I remember walking around, I think it was last year, with someone, and we're like, I have no concept even of what this game is. And the title of the game would be like, We Marry Few. And I couldn't tell you if it was on the experience of being a trans man in the South, or about being a war veteran, or about your first day of middle school. But you'd look at it, you're like, I don't get it. I don't know what this is. But this year, most of the games, I was like, oh, look, a game. And it has a title that clearly describes what it does, or a subtitle below that, where it'll be like, a game of angelic artifacts in a weird post-World War II Berlin. I'm like, oh, thank you for telling me what you are. I appreciate that. A lot of CCG space on the floor. The new Disney Arcana card game seemingly was everywhere. It is still the case that if you want to run your own RPG and you're not part of one of the groups, you have to be like 17 miles away at a hotel basement somewhere. And Gen Con's like, yeah, you're like, this is just a house in the suburbs. It's like, sure, just make sure you collect your tickets. You're like, oh, okay, is that what we're up to? Like, the economics of Gen Con just became painfully apparent. A lot of my players for Hunter were like, yeah, I have no idea what this game is, but it was the only thing open and the description kind of sounded cool. Huh. Just the supply side for RPGs is not there, which I understand, because like, Gen Con charges you between $2 and $4 per like pair of hours, so $1 to $2 an hour. And with 5 or 6 people at a table, there's just not revenue there compared to almost literally anything else you could do.
Right.
I really think those values should be doubled or tripled. If someone's going to game in person, asking them for $20 for 4 hours does not feel unreasonable, or 15. Like, a movie ticket seems like an appropriate thing to charge. If you're making it to Gen Con and you've bought a badge, I don't think you get to argue that the games are too much. Like, I can see you saying like, yeah, I wish I had more money to spend in the dealer's room. If a single die costs more than a 4-hour session of a particular game, and the die is not made with like the bones of saints, the game is not charging enough. Or at least that is my feel.
Do you think that there's been a shift away from in-person RPGing at conventions because online RPGing has become so much bigger and more accessible, with places like Start Playing Games or organized play programs like Magpie does? Do you think that has kind of taken some of the wind out of the sails of in-person con RPGing?
Not even close. Okay. If anything else, it's whet the appetite. You realize that online play for some people, of which I am one of them, is a pale methadone-like substitute for it.
Yep.
Just the ability for 3 players to all be talking at once and everyone to know what everyone else is saying, because the human mind doesn't have that problem in person, but does online, where we have but one, like generally we're getting it a mixed down mono feed. And the fact that people could point at each other and point at a thing on the table. The one change it has made is my in-person games are now much less theater of the mind. If you're going to be in a place, I had maps, I had cards representing who people were. And that was not to me because, oh, I'm running this game on behalf of the Wrecking Crew, on behalf of Renegade, on behalf of Paradox. It's just like, what would I want to sit down and play at a table? I want a tent with my name on it. I want a quick summary of the rules. I do think it has increased what people want because they are used to maybe that Roll20 experience where all the game elements are right there, just the people aren't. So now the people are, but we need to bring the game elements to them. So in almost every game that I saw or played in, the quality and volume of play aids had increased. Or maybe I just wasn't paying attention last time, but there seemed to be more physicality and more artifacts to the games that I was seeing.
What do you think you'll do differently next year?
I would like to go again next year. The strategy we did of staying off-site and getting a big unfinished house that somebody was trying to flip and obviously had not make work out worked pretty well. We wound up paying about $250 a head for housing, which I think is perfectly fine for Wednesday to Sunday. You asked earlier, like, so what did you do besides playing games? In the meantime, my spouse, Julia, went to the Indiana State Fair, which had several hundred events every day and could literally result in her going from seeing the prettiest pig competition to getting a fried six pack of donuts to then seeing the Indiana State Extreme Pogo Sticking competition, all of which were happening at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. The dollar amount that would be required to justify me running a game at something like that is probably beyond what most players would reasonably want to pay. It's just not a good use of my time, which puts me in the weird position of now just creating more demand on that other side. So of being yet another player. The other thing maybe is if the session were much shorter, like I could cut out the, here are the disposable characters, let's just go straight into it. If it were a 3-hour session, 5 hours is too damn long for me. It is exhausting. It makes it hard to recover to run another thing. So that's probably what I would do. I think the other thing that I didn't sufficiently take advantage of would be the opportunity to record interviews with people, just forgetting the sheer number and variety of people and having enough space in your calendar to say, do you have 45 free minutes at this time and this time, and I can talk to you about your new Kickstarter or something like that. And I think that would have been great because just as a game is improved by the energy of being face-to-face, I think an interview is improved by being able to look into the person's eye and being like, oh, they're not understanding this question, or they didn't think my joke was funny, I should stop, and so on. So the recurring theme I remembered was people are frequently, I forget that people are shorter than me. Like, I just assume that anyone I haven't met, I will be looking at them at eye level. And then I meet a developer and I'm like, oh, there you are. Hello. I don't actually do that. You're one of the few people that's on the opposite side where I forget how tall you are. But that was one that was constantly surprising me. I very much want to go to Gen Con again. I want to try game. It may indicate to me that I need to go to more different conventions where the table is not so radically tilted. Like with so many people, there is a high value to dealer space, and people that sell a lot of high value product are going to do the best out of that. And I don't know that titter pigs are that. Like if you had your own titter pig booth, it was because you had a bunch of games, or your game was real deep. Like the games I had never heard of that were obvious, like bites off of D&D and so on, you could buy $300 in product for just their game, either because they had a uber deluxe edition or they had a number of books. And it was like, oh, here's the core book, plus here's 7 setting books or 3 campaign books or something like that. It is not a place for someone who has one good regular RPG. If you're going to do that, you're either going to be adding to Studio 2, IPR, or the Indie Game Developer Network booth that were all up and running and moving product, which I appreciated.
What interesting finds did you come across in the dealer's hall?
The dealer's hall was two parts. One, who wasn't there? Monte Cook didn't appear to have a presence there. They were just kind of selling out of their room, and that was good enough. And there appeared to be a few people who were doing that. Or it's always possible that I just missed the Monte Cook booth, but like I couldn't find it in the directory. When I checked their webpage and their Twitter feed, it wasn't listed there. So it looks like they were just doing their standard thing of, we're going to create a good product and we are going to sell it to you for retail. And once a year, we're going to discount it 15%, or you could save things. The big thing for me was I picked up a bunch of games that had very high shipping costs to them. Because either, so Tin Star Games is located out of Australia, and every time I look at one of their Kickstarters and I look at the book and I'm like, oh, that's not bad. It's a full-size core rulebook for $40 plus $70 shipping. Oh, shit. Because it's, they don't have a drop shipper in the US and they're fulfilling out of Australia. But when they come to a convention, if you're going to be there as the developer, you may as well fill a checked bag with product for someone's booth and sell it there. So I bought all of the Tin Star games by John Dee there. Any of the little fiddly bits that are frequently sold out online, I got a bunch of tarot decks that were Kickstarter supplements and someone just had three or four extra ones and they never made it into the online store. I got a Dead Tree copy of Trenchcoats and Katanas, which is a game that is far better than it has any business being.
I remember you talking about that one from last year.
I was thrilled to pieces. That was my sleeper hit. I sometimes forget that things aren't necessarily just a copy of another thing, and things aren't just a satire of another thing, but things can be an homage. And an homage can take all sorts of points on that spectrum. It can be a deconstruction. It can be double down. It can be kind of a burlesque. And Trenchcoats and Katanas is very much a slightly tongue-in-cheek, but generally tongue-in-cheek, but with a lot of heart send-up of the old World of Darkness. And it's beautifully well-written by people who very much knew the old World of Darkness and actually kind of help elucidate it. Like, I don't know, have you ever run into like a satire of something that really helped you understand the original?
I think so, but I can't think of any examples right now.
Someone makes fun of like Star Wars and they're like, hi, I am the special person that is unreasonably good at something with no effort. And you're like, oh yeah, that is kind of a recurring theme. No one really shows any hard work unless they're a bad guy or something, whatever the trope is that they're kind of taking the wind out of. And I think Trenchcoats and Katanas does that. I got to see the new stuff from Pelgrane, which was nice. And so the conversation at that booth, I had failed to take a picture of my wall of games before I left. So I didn't know what I already had. So I go up to the booth and I'm like, what came out since last year? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I think I have everything. So the only thing that's going to be new to me is if it came out the last year. And Simon Rogers comes over and goes, well, this, and this. I'm like, okay, so what's the best way to do the buy four for the price of three promotion now? And they're like, well, which of these games are you actually playing? I'm like, none of them. And they're like, ah, you're one of those. So they're like, well, this is a really good bestiary, and this one has really nice art. These four all cost around the same, so you're not going to be in the position of saving $5. And I'm like, thanks. And I did what I always do at Gen Con, which is just have an absolute stack of cash, because cash never has processing issues. So yep. One of the click and mortar, bricks and clicks or click and mortar, what the term is when you buy the Dead Tree
and they click and mortar.
Yeah. They were having payment issues and I'm like, I will just pay with cash. And they're like, thank you. And I'm like, I just handed you cash. There is no proof that this transaction occurred. How will I get my PDFs? And they're like, oh, that's a good question. How about you write your email address down on an index card? And I'm like, can we do better than this? And they're like, we'll just send you the PDFs now. I'm like, thank you. So, but it was just weird to be like, I have these. How do they know I didn't steal it? That's interesting. So I think I made enough of an impression that wouldn't have been an issue. There were a lot of artists there as well that were just kind of generic fantasy artists. And one of the ones that always gets me is when a booth says like no pictures, but like I'm fine with that in most cases, except when the no pictures is for somebody's version of a licensed thing that they don't have the license to.
That's probably why they don't want pictures.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, yeah.
Because if pictures of their stuff go up on social media, they could get a cease and desist. But as long as it doesn't exist in the internet, it is much less likely that their corporate overlords will find them.
That's not unreasonable. I had always just presumed that it was a person not having a sense of irony. So that's good to know. But it appears that the game industry is thriving. But most of the games, when you looked over the list, they were either being run by the publisher, or if they were being run by a fan, they were like a weird IP mashup of it. Where someone's like, yeah, it's this game, but we're running it in the world of the WB Supernatural or something like that. Like, there weren't a lot of people that were just running the game qua game, but it seemed like the majority of sessions that were not Pathfinder and Dungeons and Dragons were being run by publisher crews of some sort. And I don't know if that's just the way it happens now, or if there's something that we can do to incentivize storytellers. But at the end of the day, like, running an RPG at a table in a conference room is not a time and space efficient way of making revenue. So I'm not sure how we could even change that if we wanted to.
We tried solving that with TriArtCon, where the whole point was running games and trying different games. And hopefully we'll get back to that at some point, but that's still an online experience. I'm not sure what you do in meet space to make that happen more. I also wonder, thinking about Gen Con, how much of Gen Con's revenue is RPGs versus board games, for example. Like, they've got plenty of people running D&D and Pathfinder, which are going to be the biggest chunk of the RPG revenue. And then board games bring in a ton of money. So, like, does Gen Con really care about the rest of the RPG space? And I'm not saying that, like, oh, they don't care, but, like, thinking about the financial incentives and how do you shift things to make it happen more, is Gen Con really motivated to use their space that way, which is an opportunity cost to them?
And the other thing is, they sold out of four-day badges, and they sold their 70,000, 80,000 badges. And if that's what we're looking at going forward, once you have a finite number of customers you can serve, your goal is then to increase your ARPU, your average revenue per user. And I don't know if RPGs do that if you're charging $4 for a four-hour session or something like that. So either they can try and find a way to increase the number of people that they can comfortably serve, or they can make those more high-revenue things, or they just say, hey, we're going to 20% of our slots are going to be for RPGs. That's where we come from. Like, that's our root or something like that. We need to recognize that, because obviously before Magic the Gathering, CCGs was not a big thing. But I mean, when that came out, they were still in Milwaukee. They hadn't even moved to Indianapolis. Or they could consider going to a different place, or they could do something where they have a sister convention or something like that that takes place at a couple of the hotels or something like that. That is also a phenomenon that occurs where you kind of have twin conventions where one is the professional side and one is the fan side or something like that. So there's a bunch of different ways it can go, but I think part of it is also, if it's going to be expensive, like, it is weird running into storytellers who are like, no, I come to Gen Con to run games. And I kind of want to be like, why? Like, I am glad that you are being so altruistic, but from my side, it looks like you're undergoing a lot of stress to get very little in exchange if you're paying $400 for a couple days of housing. But hey, maybe people like it that much. I just don't happen to be one of those people. Like, there were a few cases where I would stumble upon people playing Mage or something like that, and someone would be like, yeah, my group always wanted to do it, but we never were able to find a storyteller. And I would just be like, hi, you don't know me, and I was eavesdropping on your conversation, but my name is Terry, and I will run Mage for you. I will do one free online session for you. And they're like, oh, are you a professional storyteller? I'm like, hell no. This is just you getting a taste. You have to figure out your own. So we would just be like a drug dealer to being like, here's cocaine. Oh, are you going to sell me more? No, you sweet summer child. You have to go find your own dealer. So, Johnny Crackleseed. But yeah, for Mage. So I'm not sure where it goes. I also didn't get to look at the live performance side, like the people who were there because their favorite actual play group was there or something like that. That's just something I haven't engaged with, because like the real sweet inner bits, the pomegranate seeds of Gen Con, are the opportunity to try six games in a weekend. And that is worth $600 or $700 for me. Like that, I have no problem plunking down the money. But the nice thing about Gen Con is it's in Indianapolis, which is real easy to get to. There's a bunch of cool stuff on the way there, and there's a bunch of cool stuff nearby. So it's easy enough to rope a bunch of people in. So I'm going to, as long as I can continue to do the thing where we rent a house that's a mile or two out and we just bike in, that worked splendidly. The people we were staying with would walk over in the morning. It was about a 2 mile walk when they were like young and full of vigor, and would just Uber home at the end of the day when they were broken and had like $900 in board games to bring back.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Very few people were cycling in Indianapolis, and you can tell because Indianapolis is not designed for cycling. Like, it had bike lanes, but like there, in one case, there was just a pile of rebar in the bike lane. I'm surprised there weren't caltrops or a claymore mine. I regularly do inner city rides of 4 to 5 miles within Philadelphia, and going 2 miles in Indianapolis frequently felt more perilous than me riding across Philadelphia. But then again, I know Philadelphia, so so I get it. And I guess the next thing I try and do is see if I can find someone who is running games for PAX Unplugged that I can glom onto to run a bunch of sessions of Mage. Because if I can do it for free in my home city, PAX Unplugged doesn't have a huge number of games to sign up for. Perfect. That'll be my opportunity to be Terry the Evangelist for games that he likes. So I just like the idea that I may be working with like Gehenna Gaming, and they're like, our brand is horror. I'm like, I'm going to run Mage and Invisible Sun. And they're like, that's Terry. He's the weird one. So, yeah.
It kind of does highlight the need for bringing back TriotCon.
It does.
I know we talked about doing that again, so maybe we should start talking about doing that again.
Yeah, it is something that we all found valuable. It is nice when you feel like your time and effort is easily justified. Like, oh, well, that was rewarding and not expensive. That's nice.
Yeah. And now we have a framework for it. Yeah. So it, like, any other thoughts about Gen Con from this year?
It was great. This was the first time that I went and I met a bunch of people I knew through role-playing games. And there were people I only knew due to podcasting. Like, I stayed with some people I knew due to podcasting. My spouse now knows them as my podcast friends. And there was a moment where she's like, are you famous at this at all? Which is a reasonable question to ask. And I'm like,
asking you or asking me?
Me. Like, okay. Does anyone know who you are? I'm like, a couple people will know who I am. And I think 4 or 5 people stopped me to say some very nice things, and I appreciated all of them. But I'm like, I am nothing compared to the legitimate industry celebrities that are here. And she's like, legitimate industry celebrity, is that the equivalent of saying world champion tambourine player? Like, and I'm like, nah, it's a little bit bigger than that. We have a few, our A-tier celebrities would be actual C or D-list celebrities. So someone that you probably would be like, oh, wasn't that person in blah, blah, blah? Yeah, they were. So we've got a few of those. So that was neat. But I mean, Gen Con is big enough that it's 4 or 5 conventions all happening at the same time. Like, this year is the first year in 13 years I'm not going to Dragon Con. And that was always interesting because there would be 5 of us in the car and no 2 people on the way back had the same convention or even close. Whereas you and I go to Gen Con, you and I kind of had the same Gen Con. Like, yeah, more or less. But that was kind of fascinating, like getting back to the place we were staying at the end of it. And it's like, yeah, we saw this improv comedy troupe. And then I saw this person play the hammer dulcimer. And then I had this poet. Then I attended this rock anthem poetry reading. I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing. I'm glad. It was great going back to a convention. And it is to the point where I am considering doing what I would have considered tier 2 events, like midwinter maybe this year. So we'll see if that makes sense. I have a lot of airline miles that I haven't used yet. So maybe that's how I burn through some of them.
I wonder if those smaller conventions are going to have the better seats at table to storytellers ratio than a giant event like Gen Con.
Yeah. The one nice thing about a giant event like Gen Con is you're much more likely to pull in normies.
Okay.
And that's kind of fun. You're like, oh, you're a normal person and you just happen to be at Gen Con. But if you're at like Midwinter or you're at Ice and Dice or you're at 1D4 Con, like, you have sought out this hotel basement to be or like somebody in a very sexy cosplay, like a kid recognized the character, like is just familiar and has no idea about the sexualization of the character. And they're just like, Mom, take my picture. And it's just like, also something you don't get at online conventions.
Hopefully next year I'll be able to join you in your rented space. I know we had planned that in 2020, and it's been a number of years since then.
Yes.
And
We tried, though. We tried.
We really tried. 2020 was going to be like my peak convention year. I was going to go to the D20 Radio convention in Texas on the same trip as a work trip. So work was going to pay for my flight. It was going to be glorious. Then I was going to go to Gen Con and PAX. And I was even thinking about going to Midwinter that year. And that happened. Yeah.
It is one of those weird things where you're like, yeah, I didn't do anything in that year. All I did was produce an immense amount of podcast audio and a whole bunch of shit for the Storytell Revolt. So like, to some extent, for me at least, it was like hydraulic. Like all the energy that didn't go into this actually went going here. And now I'm on the other end of it and I'm like, how did I produce 52 podcast episodes in a year? It's like, Terry, you didn't have a social life. You weren't a member of an opera company. Everyone was home and afraid. And I'm like, ah, the golden times. But if you would like to come down for PAX Unplugged, I'd love to host you and yours.
I think by next year, conventions may start happening again. I may also try to hit up one of the local conventions sooner than that. I know there's one in central Massachusetts that happens like in February. I forget what it's called, but I may try to go to that this year since that's in staying at home distance.
That is a very useful distance.
And yes.
Any convention where you can go home for dinner is has some real nice fringe benefits to it. Have you been playing anything, Chaz?
I have.
Okay.
I've been playing Root, the RPG, run by our friend Noah. And that's been a lot of fun. We've been playing long enough that we've advanced our characters some now. I'm at the point where I feel like, huh, this character is really competent. I don't know what I would spend further advances on right now. Because we kind of have a neat balance. That has led to me doing, like, art of the characters for that game. I've gotten back into drawing for the first time in, like, a decade and a half. And that's been a lot of fun. I have been writing and developing Exalted stuff. We just got the finals in for approval on Abyssals, so that will likely be coming to Kickstarter later this year. I'm writing a whole Exalt type in the Exigence Companion, one of the design seeds there. I have the first print book with my name in it in hand at this point. I actually got two different things. I wrote one of the clearings for Root for Magpie, and they ended up publishing it as their free RPG Day supplement this year. So I went and got that, and at the local store signed every copy that they were giving away for free RPG Day, which was kind of neat. I came in the day ahead of time and just went through their 40-something copies and signed all of them. So anyone who picked up copies in Worcester at That's Entertainment got signed copies of Root the RPG Quick Start. And the other thing is I got my POD copy of Tome of the Pentacle for Blue Mage, which is the first full print book that I have in hand with my name in it. It's kind of been a neat couple months. I hope to be getting back to actually running some Exalted in the not too distant future. And then, like I said, within the next year, getting back to conventions.
Nice. Well, I hope we get to do that. And if we do, I look forward to talking about it again on Pain in the Dice.
Have a good one.